The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 1052. It's the 26th of April, 2018. It's a Thursday. And by the way, check out our latest podcast series. It's called Business Lives, and the podcast features interviews with high-profile guests in the world of business. Okay, today's podcast, I have Tony Gilby, Managing Director of Talou Energy, the TLOU, and Tony talks through some of the highlights from their recent operational update. Good long chat we have, too. Also on the podcast, Kelly Kavanagh, Finance Director of Highlands Natural Resources, HNR ticker there, and Kelly discusses recent updates at the company, including the funding of their East Denver project for a 6 further wells. Plus, I have Chris Bailey on the podcast also, who's founder of financialorbit.com. And Chris covers some news from Royal Dutch Shell, RDSB, Barclays, B-A-R-C, Bark, and Taylor Wimpey, TW Dot. Plus, I have, as always, the top 5 most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top 5 most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tony Gilby, Managing Director of Talou Energy. That's T-L-O-U ticker. Thank you for joining me, Tony.
Good morning, Justin. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, well, you've just released an operational report, and we'll go through some of the details of that. We've got some questions as well from private investors, so we'll dig into it. Before we do, Tony, these people new listening to the podcast all the time, new investors, and some of them may not have heard of Talou Energy. So can you summarise what the company's all about, please?
Indeed. We're the most advanced gas-to-power company in the whole country of Botswana, one of the best countries in Africa to do business. We have independently certified gas reserves, a mining lease, environmental approval for the upstream, and a very big upside in our development potential and therefore our share price potential, Justin.
Excellent stuff. So you've got this gas to power in Botswana, which you've previously said is a, and also that region is they are sort of energy hungry, and so they need that kind of energy. And so you are the most advanced in Botswana. At the moment, it seems like you've got several strategies for getting power into the grid and selling it. So I suppose the most well-known one is the request for proposal from the government, isn't it? So can you explain how that's going at the moment, please, Tony?
Yes, indeed, Justin. I'll refer to the RFP, request for proposal, as a tender. That's what it really is. Mm-hmm. But it's a closed tender. It's only between two parties. And we've been informed by the government that the previous process really came to naught via a procedural issue rather than anything fundamental with the process, and that the tender will be reissued and to the same two parties, and we're confident that will happen within a reasonable time frame. I can't give a specific time frame on that, but we're confident based on what the government's told us that tender will be reissued. We have alternative ways to the connect to the grid in any event, Justin, and that's via a direct power purchase agreement with either Botswana Power Corp or the equivalent. We could sell power to a third-party country or entity within Botswana. And, of course, we could always directly connect to the grid in any event and sell into the spot market, because there's always periods of time when there's an acute shortage of electricity, and our process is one that can be started up instantaneously. So they're the options for us, and we're confident that one way, shape or form, one of those options will come to fruition in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, excellent. So just to explain, I mean, like you said, it's had a bit of delay because it was knocked back because of essentially what seems like an admin kind of error on the tender process there. So what are the advantages in going down this route? Because I know you're resubmitting, like you say. What's the advantages going down this route as opposed to the other two?
Well, the The simplest way really is direct negotiation. However, the previous minister or two ministers back, this process was going on for quite a long period of time, decided that they would make a larger process, a greater number of megawatts available via the tender process. Now, that didn't really suit us. That got out of our control a little bit. We've only ever wanted, sort of 1 to 10 megawatts initially and then expand from there. But because the government, initiated by the two ministers back, was very keen on the tender process, we thought, well, OK, we'll go down that process, and we're very confident. It did, however, as a lot of these government processes do, it developed a life of its own and became quite complicated. And then that particular minister wasn't in charge when this tender was finalised, and therefore it got a little bit lost within the system. Now, in hindsight, we should have just pushed for a direct negotiation, which is within the minister's ability to grant a direct negotiation with either Botswana Power Corp or the Public Procurement and Asset Disposal Board. And I was over in Botswana recently for a couple of weeks meeting with all key stakeholders, and Botswana Power Corp told me directly that I can tell anyone and everyone who cares to listen that they're fully behind our project and would love to directly negotiate with us for a small a pilot project initially. It still needs ministerial direction, so that's what we're hoping will happen as a parallel process or even a replacement process to the tender. We'll see how that goes. But we're not just relying on that, Justin. We're also working on other ways of connecting to the grid as well. So as I said before, one way, shape or form, we're confident that we'll develop the momentum to connect to the grid. And then that is principally our last remaining significant risk overcome.
Yeah. But going back to that, Tony, I mean, people say you've got three options, and yet it seems like quite a protracted way of going about it with going via the tender process. So the advantage is what? Is that they give you an offtake agreement that is what is would make it easy for you to gain funding for the plant? Is that the case?
Well, a PPA lowers the cost of capital,
yeah.
Justin. Now, if we had a spare $20 million US in the bank, we would just go it alone, and then we would partner from whatever else we needed, because we're very confident that once connected to the grid, that the demand side will be there, and we'll be able to sell our product. But whilst we don't have 20 in the bank, we have about 5.9 Aussie as of the last quarterly, and that means we have to trade warily. We have to look at the cheapest form of additional future funding, and that best form of funding, the cheapest form of funding, is out of Botswana itself. And we know again from my series of meetings over there and the team's meetings over there that the Botswanan entities with very deep pockets are ready and willing to fund us. The last hurdle, which will make their funding much more efficient, I guess, and a lower price for us, and of greater certainty, will be a PPA of some sort. And that is our primary objective at the moment, is to get a PPA. In parallel, though, we will continue to acquire all of the approvals and seek a generation license, seek a connection to the grid license, all in parallel, seek all the environmental approvals, such that with time, depending how long a PPA takes, we'll have everything in place to move the project rapidly forward when everything falls into place.
Okay, I see. So, you know, ideally it's via the government tender process and getting a power purchase agreement, but, you know, that's not the only way. Like you say, there's two other ways as well. You go via, say, Botswana Development Corporation, or just into the grid and sell via spot prices. So and of course, I mean, someone did ask this, so what's the time frame for all this? What's the actual time frame? It's hard to tell. I mean, it's not just Botswana, but I've talked to companies that deal with governments all around the world. And whenever governments are involved, there's always seems like there's, you know, you could never actually put a deadline on it, I know, because no one knows how these governments work or how fast they work. But internally for Tilau Energy, what is your time frame for hopefully getting power into the grid?
Well, I think the first question is how long do we think a PPA will take, or otherwise to bridge the gap with internal Botswanan funding, Botswana funding processes to bridge the gap. The alternative is to bridge that gap to simply move towards grid connection and to bring in the appropriate partners. So with a PPA, we would hope and anticipate that it won't be too much longer. The reason why I can't put a time frame on it is exactly as you mentioned in your preamble to my answer. Dealing with governments, it's very difficult to tell. We have room to be optimistic, however, when we look at the full range of approvals that we've already achieved within the Botswana system. The first big approval we sought was the granting of environmental approval for all of the upstream development. Now, that took 2 years of hard work and dotted all the I's, crossed all the T's, and indeed it was forthcoming. But that was really taken mainly up, though, with all the work, all the public consultations, etc. And then once we submitted that material, it was actually approved within a matter of weeks. In relation to the mining licence, now, that could have dragged on for a very long period of time, but we were very, very pleasantly surprised and pleased that the government of Botswana turned that around in a matter of weeks, really, from submitting, and it only took us a few weeks to pull together the required information, which primarily built on earlier work. So we have grounds to be optimistic that once the focus is there by the government, and obviously they have many priorities, once the focus is there, that approval for a direct award of a PPA or this re-tender with what we anticipate to be more reasonable terms in the first instance, such that it doesn't run the risk of being cancelled again. But once all that comes together, we are optimistic that it shouldn't take too long to be awarded. Mm-hmm. So we'll wait and see, Justin, and but we do remain optimistic.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to the action on the ground, as it were, and the gas reserves and the activity there. I've seen the operational highlights. The first core hole is to be drilled at Mamba area. That was completed successfully. And you've also bought a drilling rig. So take us through what's happening there, Tony.
We're moving slowly but surely into becoming more in control of our own destiny. That's one of our guiding principles at the moment, and it's subject to funding, of course. Now, we're able to secure a very low hours a core rig that became available in Australia because the contract was cancelled and it was a stranded asset for the vendor. We picked it up very cheaply within existing funds, and that's in the process of being shipped to Botswana now. So, in other words, future core hole campaigns, which the system reserve delineation and exploring our 8,000 square kilometres will be much cheaper and much more within our control. We'll be able to employ local people. We found with our seismic program late last year that there's some very good local workers. We'd love to get them back working for us again with future drilling campaigns, not only seismic, so we have the right personnel there. We'll be able to significantly lower the cost of future core hole drilling, and we'll be able to do that in times of or downtime, if you will, between larger aspects of the project. So that's one of the key objectives which we've been able to fulfil, and we'll continue to look in the future, subject to funding, and I'd hope to get the funds out of Botswana at some point in time to actually buy a production rig as well, Justin. And the rationale for that is exactly the same as the rationale with the core rig. It becomes more under our control. One of the largest costs with third-party with drilling are the third party costs and breakdowns, etc. We can't structure a program that minimises the amount of expensive time on the ground. So it means costs much more within our control. So that the latter is more of a future objective, and we've achieved the former objective of obtaining a core rig to assist with our future core hole campaigns.
Yeah, but are you? I mean, you're quite optimistic about the size and increasing the size of your reserves, are you?
Well, we've booked a considerable amount of reserves now, and we're very happy with that, and I think the market is happy with that. Mm-hmm. I am very confident that we now have the template to book more reserves. So it's just more or less a process now, Justin.
Yeah.
We know what the geology looks like. We have our own core rig. We know how to carry out a seismic program, as evidenced last year. We're very confident we can drill new production wells cheaper and more efficiently now. The immediate future campaign for later this year will almost certainly have to be with a local rig still, which adds an element of risk, but we don't obviously have the funds to acquire a production rig yet. Mm-hmm. So we've got all that laid out. We know how to book more reserves. We'll book more reserves in the future. But the objective, the primary objective of the company, is to secure a PPA or some other method to directly connect to that grid, because that will give the investment market confidence that we can indeed sell our product.
Yeah. So essentially, I mean, obviously mostly this podcast listened to by investors, but you're saying funding with this would be via PPA rather than equity dilution. Is that what you're saying?
I think there will be a degree of equity capital raisings in the future. Our objective is to bring those funds and that capital out of Botswana. And, you know, it's a balance. It's a balance between equity, depends on your price, and the price of debt. Mm-hmm. Future funding will be looking at both. What is the cheapest cost of capital for us? Now, I've maintained, and based on the listing in Botswana last year, where African Alliance is now our largest shareholder, representing Botswana pension funds. Now, that is good that local shareholders and investors within the country that we're doing business have a significant equity stake in the company. So I don't mind that. If a price was reasonable, I don't mind equity elsewhere. We still only have a little over 300 odd million shares on issue. So we're in a pretty strong position. It all comes back to that key point, Justin, of cost of capital, whether it be debt, whether it be equity, preferences to raise it, those within country as in the first instance.
Yeah, okay. And talking about sort of in country there, I mean, there's been a change of government, if I'm not mistaken, and have you had meetings, or is I know Gbaki or Gigi, your executive director there, ex of government, has he been having meetings? And if so, how has it been going? Are they sort of pro-business? Are they easy to deal with?
Well, they've just been settling in from early April, a new president. We also have a new minister. Gbaki, of course, is aware and has met these gentlemen before. And once they settle in, and in the process of settling in, he will see them and push our barrow, so to speak, and draw their attention to our project and the significant upside for power energy security within the country, and indeed for employment. Now, they're very, very big issues. When I was over there recently, there was a full-page ad by the outgoing president stating that it's the same party with a new president, stating that the or one of the key objectives of the party is to increase employment. Now, we are one of the keys to that, and so we're very confident that we're offering a very positive product for the company, that for the country, that it is in alignment with the country's objectives, political and social objectives and economic objectives, and therefore we're confident with pushing our burrow to anyone and everyone that will listen, that will eventually get traction, and we're confident that will be sooner rather than later, Justin.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I'm aware. Last question, we've been looking at the short term workings of Te Lau, but I mean, as far as the project is concerned, and with your experience, of course, you've done this kind of thing before. An overview on a mid to long term basis, are you still happy with what's happening, and are you still in more than ever convinced of the potential upside here?
Oh, absolutely, and I think that is not just me being optimistic. We can look at the reserve growth through work on the ground that we've been able to achieve. We can look at our very large contingent resource base, which invariably gets converted to reserves. We have a very large portion of our acreage that is still to be fully evaluated. So I'm very confident with the booking of reserves, and that adds real value to the company. We need to, and we will at some stage, secure the process, secure the process to connect to the grid. Once we do that, we've pretty well tied all the key loops, and with the need for energy unabating, another little side point, when I was over in Botswana, there is definitely a push for solar. Now, we know, and I've introduced a concept, and it was received very well, that not only do we offer energy security and employment, but solar combined with our gas is very, very efficient and unlocks efficient sources of funding. So, in fact, within our proposal for our pilot plant will be some solar as well. Now, that's gone over very, very well, Justin. And it's gone over well because it's logical. It just makes sense based on worldwide experiences. It just makes sense. So the project is compelling from an economic and a technical perspective, and that's why I remain very optimistic.
Yeah, and yeah, I did see this solar mentioned there. It's very interesting there, you're going with solar. When did this thought first come up, the solar operation?
Well, it came up because if we back up a little bit to the tender process, it was very, very involved. The good thing about the tender process, even if we end up just directly negotiating with the government for a pilot power generation project, the good thing about the tender process is we pulled together a team of engineers, we fully costed, modelled, and sought expert technical advice on the poles and wires and the generation side of the process of the project. And the poles and wires, for example, was very cost effective to put in a line that will not only take as little as a couple of megawatts, but it will take up to 25 megawatts and more without the need to expand those poles and wires. So for the you can build cheaper poles and wires, but just for minor incremental cost, those poles and wires will take much, much more capacity. So then we started to think, well, how can we readily expand once we put in half a dozen megawatts of gas-fired power? How can we rapidly expand that? Because we can't expand any quicker than what we can drill wells.
Yeah.
On the gas-fired power generation, but what we can do, we can actually match that, whatever we put in with gas, with solar. Now, solar's price, we've had our engineers look at that, and that's priced anywhere between $300 and $1 million, depending on what you get and how you install it, etc., per megawatt. Now, the good thing about that is that's relatively cheap compared to the upstream gas-fired power generation, and the poles and wires, most expensive part of the downstream, can take that readily. So whatever we do in gas, we would endeavour to match that with solar. That appeals to a wider range of investors. It appeals more to the internal investment entities within Botswana. It appeals to the external government funds that we're talking to back this project. It enhances the appeal of the project, rather. You don't just simply California, from my understanding, is 50%, about 50% renewables. The other 50% is gas. For example, a very green state within the US. Many solar projects have tried to get off the ground in Botswana, but to my knowledge, they've all failed because they don't have the baseload underpinning it adjusted. So yeah. So it's a neat solution for us to double our capacity during the day and to appeal to a wider investment base. So that's how it came about.
Yeah, and I tell you, you don't have to change your logo because you've got a big sun there just behind an elephant. So that's perfect for solar. That's ideal.
I hadn't realised that, but now you mention it, you're exactly right.
Yeah. Okay, well, Tony, final thing, if someone's listening to this now and likes the sound of what you're doing but are not following the story, three quick reasons, please, why someone should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, we're the most advanced gas-to-power development company in all of Botswana, one of the best countries in Africa to do business. We have independently certified reserves, a mining lease, environmental approval for the upstream, and in the process of achieving that for the downstream. And we have a big upside for the company and shareholders intact based on a firm plan to bring the various fuel processes more under our control and to achieve a grid connection so that we can have a clear pathway to sell our product, Justin.
Marvellous stuff, Tony. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Cully Cabanis, Vice President of Finance at Highlands Natural Resources. HNR is ticker there. Cully, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Justin, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on the Vox podcast with you.
Yeah, it's been a while, and you've released a massive amount of news, and we'll catch up on the last few bits of significant news, I suppose. But before we do, Cully, for people listening right now who are not quite familiar with the company, can you summarize what Highlands Natural Resources is all about, please?
Absolutely, absolutely. Highlands has three core projects. The main project, which we have the most news to share with you today, is a shale project based in Colorado in the United States, where we already have two wells producing. They're horizontal shale wells in the Niobrara Shale. And we just announced a major financing that's going to fully fund at least six more wells, potentially up to 24 total wells. So there's a immediate cash flow impact from that. And then the other two projects, they're really quite interesting and unique in the oil and gas space. One is DT Ultravert. It's a technology where we have four patents allowed and additional patents pending. And it is a technology around the protection of parent wells. It has to do with when a new well is fracked near an old well, protecting the old well and enhancing the new well. And it has really broad implications, could really potentially change the entire shale industry as it matures. And then the third project is Helios 2, where we have more than 220,000 acres in Montana where we've discovered methane and we've discovered helium, which is a very valuable gas. And that's just a big upside project. There's definitely risk there, but of course when you scale anything across 220,000 acres, the impact for a small company like Highlands can be really, really significant.
Yeah, well, let's go back to that bit of news first and foremost on DT Ultravert, and you've successful Permian Basin deployment of that technology. Take us through the details there, if you could, Cully.
Absolutely, yeah. We could not be more pleased with this. So we've been working to commercialize DT Ultravert, and first I'll mention that we've been putting a lot of effort into the marketing of DT Ultravert, and earlier this year we went down to NAEP, which is the North American Prospect Expo in Houston. I've actually been going to NAEP with my dad since I was 14 years old, and this year there were 14,000 people that attended. It's really everyone in the North American and frankly international oil and gas industry attends, and we exhibited there prominently. We were a platinum sponsor. We handed out more than 3,000 Highlands ball caps, and we got the message about DT Ultravert really to the entire industry. We wanted to basically come out, share some of our really exciting results with the industry, and tell them about how our technology can protect their parent wells in the shale basin and enhance their child wells. And we shared with the industry that we've done this successfully now in two vertical wells in the Piceance Basin and two horizontal wells in the Permian Basin. So really it's just been repeated results. And you know, your question was to share the more recent results. And so in the Permian Basin, which is the most active shale basin in the United States, we just did a deployment of DT Ultravert where there was a history of well bashing in this field, and the child wells were underperforming expectations. And so what we did is we injected high-pressure gas into the two parent wells, and when they did the next batch of child wells, they were significantly improved, up to 19% better than the ones that hadn't been protected by DT Ultravert. And so, you know, when you look at a 19% impact, on average it was 15%, up to 19%, and you look at that on the economic impact of a horizontal shale well, it really is dramatic. I mean, these wells will produce millions and millions of dollars, you know, tens of millions in revenue over their lives. So a percentage improvement like that, it really matters compared to what amounts to a six-figure deployment cost. And that, we think we just basically demonstrated an economic case for this technology, which we think is bringing us closer to that tipping point of technology adoption that we've been waiting for the last couple of years as we've advanced the patents and now just deploying the technology on a more commercial basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's come to last week. You announced you've secured a gas purchase agreement. Take us through this, if you could, Cully.
Yeah, and actually, the gas purchase agreement was a precursor to what's the bigger news, which is the financing. So okay. The gas purchase agreement was definitely significant. You know, we're looking to scale up the East Denver project. We already had two wells producing, and we believed that in order to get the final funding from a third party, we wanted to do this in a non-dilutive way by using industry partnership capital or private equity capital from the United States. We believed that to secure a deal like that, we needed a pipeline agreement. And so we announced that we secured the pipeline agreement, and we announced that the two wells have already produced 190,000 barrels of oil equivalent just in 5 months since we brought them online. So top 3% wells in the entire Niobrara play. We just have some great reserves and some great wells in our hands here. And the pipeline deal paved the way to completing the funding, which we announced on Friday. Mm-hmm. And the funding is really the exciting news because we brought in the True Family Oil Company. It's a major, highly respected private business from Wyoming in the United States. The company and its related companies are active across banking, ranching, oil and gas, midstream. And this firm is going to come in and drill the next six wells. We are now effectively carried in the project. Our partners are funding 100% of the capital costs going forward. Highlands retains a 7.5% interest in the project for free. We were also paid $5 million in cash up front, and that's on top of the $3.8 million in cash that we've already generated net to Highlands based on the production that I mentioned from the first two wells. So we've already, you know, really done quite well with the project, and going forward, it's just a free carried interest, and there's going to be a ton of news flow coming from those six wells, which they're already beginning to drill now.
Yeah, I suppose it can't help the oil prices up where it is at the moment.
It absolutely is. Yeah, that's good news. You know, the oil price, it definitely doesn't hurt. When we acquired these assets, oil prices were down in the 40s, mm-hmm. and now we're up in the 70s, 70 range, which is obviously a really beneficial thing when we look at the overall economics.
Okay, so someone listening to this right now, Cully, what will be the sort of next bit of milestone, next bit of big news or the next milestone you're hoping to achieve here at Highlands?
Well, you know, we're just going to inundate the market, first of all, with news flow when it comes to operational updates, because we're going to be drilling six wells on a pad basis, again, with the True partnership now in place, and then it's going to be fracking six wells in sequence, and then it's going to be flowing back six wells, and the results of those six, we expect them to be similar to the first two. And if that's the case, we are going to become a major producer of oil and gas as we bring on six more of these extended horizontal wells in the Niobrara Shale. So that is for sure a major milestone for Highlands, and the whole team just couldn't be more pleased with the outcome and who we ended up working with.
Yeah, okay, excellent stuff. Well, Kelly, if someone's listening to this and likes the sound of this deal, this funding, this financing, and what you're doing with DT Ultravert, and of course you've got Helios 2 as well, so they like the story but are not yet following you on Vox Markets, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Absolutely. So reason number one is that the East Denver strategy, it is highly repeatable throughout the entire Denver-Julesburg Basin. We've proven the model at East Denver, where we have acquired the land with a creative and low upfront cost transaction. Then we funded the development program, and we've really successfully executed. Our first two wells, again, are in the top 3% of all Niobrara wells, where there are more than 4,000 other wells. So it's an important data point. And we're going to do that again. We're already hard at work, and investors can see our latest corporate update presentation where we highlight all the areas in Colorado where we think this is possible to repeat. And so just layering on these carried interests can really grow our business quickly that way. The second reason to follow Highlands is, of course, DT Ultravert, which is a technology that can revolutionize the industry. We think that there are tens of thousands of wells that are going to need this technology over time. There's a recent court ruling from a federal jury in Oklahoma that seems to be indicating that this technology may be even required in many cases. And so, again, getting close to that tipping point for the technology adoption. And the third reason is Helios 2, where we have more than 220,000 acres in Montana, and there's more than a mile of sediments in this area. And two horizons we've already tested have generated natural gas flares, and we found helium in the concentrations that we expected. And there's more work to do up there, more formations to evaluate. So whenever you have 220,000 acres of a region that's in the vicinity of known oil and gas production, then you definitely have a big opportunity, and we could have some exciting upside there.
Absolutely. Excellent stuff, Kelly. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Again, we really appreciate the opportunity to come on to the podcast with you, and of course, we'll keep you updated and your listeners updated, and whenever we have something to share, we'll let you know.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. You're right, Chris?
Yeah, very well. Thank you very much, Justin.
And if someone goes to financialorbit.com, what's the kind of stuff they can expect there, Chris?
They get, I sort of put up some stuff for free in there. So it's sort of macroeconomic stuff, a few links to some company articles that I've written. It's sort of like my free to the air bit for everybody to look at. So cool. Occasionally links to if I'm on the TV, links to this podcast and other stuff like that. So
definitely go there then. Yeah, and share
right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So watch out for that and then a few other things as well. But yes, it's my free to wear piece that people can look at.
Yeah. Okay. Marvelous stuff. Okay. Well, let's get into some stocks, some bigger stocks this week. Well, today we've been reporting. So who's been reporting, Chris?
Well, we've got to start with Shell, haven't we? Or Royal Dutch Shell, as they're proudly known. At least, despite their Anglo-Dutch heritage, at least they're not doing a Unilever running away from the UK stock market. But there you go. Look, it's a popular share for many reasons. Obviously, been around forever. Big dividend yield and oil has recovered as well. And you can see that in the numbers today. The numbers at face value look absolutely fantastic. Profits up sharply. The dividend is held, which obviously has been a concern over recent years. They were going to have to cut the dividend. Dividend's held again, so you're still getting that 5-6% yield. And they're still making good noises about cash flow, covering not only the dividend, but their hopes for investing into the business and even buying back a few shares. So at many levels, looks good. So the question then is, why is the share, when I last looked, was down 1.5-2%? And the reason is quite clear to me. You look at the share price chart, this one has absolutely romped in recent weeks. In fact, the whole energy sector has gone up. It's not just the oil price. I think it's a realization that people have said, well, you know, actually maybe we fancy a bit of energy dividend yield rather than technology hit and hope. And there's been a positive rotation towards the space helped by this rise in the oil price. Mm-hmm. But bottom line is, we're now at that sort of more difficult point for these shares because they've done all the easy stuff in the sense of they've reduced their debt, they've generated the positive cash flow. The question is, they've got to keep the game going in terms of their production growth. Shell's production growth, as announced today, was only 2%. And the trouble is they've been really tight over recent years on spending money because, you know, oil price was lower, that they had to pay for the BG acquisition and stuff like that. So they've got to put money back into spending on developing new fields. And I think that's what's, they'll have the conference call later on. I think that's what will exercise people. People will be thinking, well, hang on, you know, they've got to start spending a bit of money now. It's not quite as rosy as people would think. So I think a little bit of a pause whilst we wait for the next leg on how they're going to spend the money and develop new fields.
Yeah, I mean, there was that, of course. And it always happens, isn't it? It creates a boom and bust environment because these big companies pay dividends. And they're going to stick to them. They say, we will stick to the dividend. You know, when the oil price goes down, they pull back on the exploration costs. And then you've got, in a couple of years' time, all these big companies, you've got a lack of oil. And so the share price goes nuts. And then, we can explore more now because we haven't got enough oil. So it goes up and down, doesn't it? It's crazy.
But, that's right. That's yeah. Right. It is a volatile sector, no doubt. And clearly, what is known as the integrated oil companies like Shell and BP, because they have what is known as upstream, which is the exploration and related side. They have downstream, which is all the refining and related stuff, even the service stations, etc. Yeah. You know, they're sort of a bit hedged across all points of the curve. But ultimately, you're absolutely right. They need to find new sources of oil and gas or related. And the last few years, all of these big oil and gas companies haven't been spending enough money on developing those fields. That's been good for paying the dividend, which has been a popular investor concern over recent years with these names. But now they're going to have to do something. Because 2% production growth is not great, you know, and ultimately, is that in their interest to keep it at that level and remain very prudent? The answer is no. So the game is going to change a little bit. My guess is what we'll see is them spending more money on some of the fields they have. It may well lead to some M&A activity in the fullness of time. But bottom line is, look, it's an all right company. There's nothing inherently wrong with Shell. I just think you've got to be cognizant of the price action, and 26 quid's a bit of a resistance point, and it has romped to that level in double quick time from a number of pounds lower just a few months ago.
Yeah, well, this is what I use charts for. I mean, I do have Nicola Duke, who's an excellent chartist on the podcast every day, and she goes into everything from Fibonacci's and all this and I think, you know, listen, on a basic level, always look at a chart, because if you like the fundamentals of a company, you can buy a good company, like I said, at the wrong price. And at the moment, it seems like Shell is at the wrong price, you know, and that £26 level, yes, it's been there, it's tested it before, it failed, and it looks like it's doing it again. So I'd wait for it to settle now, and it's the support levels at like 24, 23, 22, so, you know, just sit and wait, because this is not the right time to buy Shell by the looks of it, you know?
Yeah, I would totally agree. And sure, if you want dividend and whatever, you're probably unfussed either way. But it matters. Even a big 6% yield, you know, a 6% move in the share at a certain level, if it goes down, wipes out your dividend return from a total return perspective. So you've got to always be aware of where the share is, even if you're a dividend-focused investor, because clearly if you can get a double whammy, and that's what the most successful dividend investors have done. They've worked out that not ignoring the capital growth potential angle as well as the income one, is the key to success.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. What's next, Chris?
So Shell is sort of has done really well recently. Barclays has been a bit all over the place, and it's obviously been a very difficult last year or two for Barclays. You know, we've got over the global financial crisis sort of finally with these names. They've made a bit of progress in sharpening up their act, but only so much. I mean, the CEO obviously got raked over the coals even and recently the FCA also imposed a big fine because of actions regarding a whistleblower where he really did do a pretty shabby job. There's obviously still been some outstanding legal settlements they've got, and they've settled some with the US in recent months, and there's still a couple outstanding. So it's been a tough old environment for Barclays, and we all know that traditional retail banking is sort of a bit under pressure. It's changing. You know, branches are closing. We're all going online. Corporate banking goes up and down a bit with the economic cycle. And the investment banking, which is their other business, well, you know, that's highly leveraged always. Barclays has been a bit of an underperformer. And it's picked up in recent months an activist shareholder, who obviously activists are getting a lot of press in the UK at the moment. You know, we've seen names like Whitbread yesterday react to activist pressure and, you know, spinning off Costa Coffee in the fullness of time, etc., etc. GKN, of course, had effectively activist interest. Barclays has picked up an activist investor. They're holding just over 5% of the company, and certainly they're agitating for a bit of change. Because if you look at Barclays, one of the measures that you sort of look bank stocks or sort of appraise them at is the book value. And Barclays trades below book value. Now, we all know banks are kind of complex beasts in terms of their real worth. But for a bank to trade below book value, that's striking, particularly when, if you look at the numbers today, Barclays is not in too bad a shape. They're generating capital. Profits sort of went up if you ignore some of the litigation costs. And they confirmed a 6.5p dividend, which is 3% and change dividend yield. So superficially, Barclays is doing all right. It's a kind of interesting they're still trading below book value. So my feeling would be book value is about 250p. And I reckon the activist shareholder is basically agitating for them to keep on sharpening up their act, communicating better, and is hoping for a return to that book value level, which obviously would be, you know, circa 20% above this level. So bottom line is, I think Barclays, it's a bit been a bit all over the place, maybe moving into a better spot, assisted by one of their shareholders.
Yeah. And do you know what? I noticed today a headline, apparently, Barclays have hooked up with PayPal to do some kind of payment process.
They just discovered it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, a thing called PayPal.
I think it's odd, really, when you get all this crypto happening and all, you know, cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, all this, you know, cutting edge sort of payments or technologies, that PayPal is seeming a little bit, even though I use it a lot and I find it very handy, is seeming a little bit dated now. But Barclays now are really just hooking up with PayPal. I'm thinking, guys, you're several years behind the curve here. You know, you should be hooking up with some kind of Bitcoin sort of provider or something, or that kind of technology. But anyway,
it could be worse, Justin. They could do a TSB and sort of have a computer system which didn't work. But there you go. Once they've upgraded from the hamster running around to power it or something,
exactly.
As TSB have done. So, you know, sometimes caution on the technology side can be sort of all right too, particularly for something like a bank. Saying that, Barclays actually have been in the vanguard of the digital revolution from their perspective in UK banking. They actually have been pretty good on that front. And, you know, I don't know the inner details of their PayPal link up, but bottom line is they've not been shy about pushing the whole digital revolution. And like it or loathe it, it's how most people now access their bank account. We don't need to go into the branches anywhere near as much as we did even 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah. No, listen, I welcome it. I bank with Barclays and I also use PayPal, so if they can, I don't know how they'd make it any more seamless for me, but it seems to work. Okay, so we've had a big resource stock, energy company, Shell, a big bank. What's next, Chris?
Yeah, we've got to have a quick look at Taylor Wimpey in the house building space.
Yeah.
They've got an AGM statement today, big AGM season at the moment, annual general meetings, lots of companies are having them, speaking with shareholders and talking about prospects. If you look at the Taylor Wimpey AGM statement, you know, they said that trading had been good, customer demand had been strong, good access to mortgages and still things like that are working in terms of the property market. and they're on track to meet their expectations for this year. So all of that is ticks in the boxes. You think,
down 4%.
That's fantastic. Why is it down 3-4%? Absolutely. And the reason is that with investments, it's funny. You know, it's not so much responding to what you see, it's responding to where you're going. And just as we talked about with Shell, that actually the numbers were great, but kind of the future has new challenges. And for Barclays, if you like, the valuation is low because people are still too obsessed about the past and not maybe looking at a better future. With Taylor Wimpey, it's the other way around. You know, property market is slowing. We can see it. Maybe the Bank of England edges up interest rates. And you put all of those sort of things together, it's not as conducive a backdrop for property and house building stocks. Yeah. And, you know, the history of this sector is it anticipates what's going to happen over the next year or two. And that's what's happening in the Taylor Wimpey share price. You know, it's as good as it's going to get on the historic numbers or even current trading. But tomorrow is going to be a bit harder. They're going to find it a struggle to crack on from these sort of operating levels and profits and everything else. And consequently, the share rolls over, you know, to use a technical phrase. So, you know, I'm not surprised. I don't have any exposure to this area. I know it's popular. Dividend yield, people perceiving value, a shortage of homes in the country, et cetera, et cetera. I think though some of the macro headwinds are not good for the sentiment towards this space. And my feeling is you look at history, that's the way it is with this sector. So, not one for me at the moment, I'm afraid. And yeah, I wanted to just to bring to people's attention that kind of interesting, if you like, a contrast between the tone of the statement and the reaction of the shares. Always an interesting thing to look out for.
Yeah, I was just thinking the other day, I mean, I have a flat and I sort of rented out, but the interest rate is not fixed. And I was thinking, okay, should I just keep this? Because at the moment it's okay. I'm making a little bit of profit on it and the rent and stuff like that. And I thought, what happens now if the interest rate goes up? That will be cut back. I mean, and trouble is, if I want to sell it then and the interest rates are going up, it's not going to be easy. And I thought, what's going to make the housing market more buoyant? And I thought, the only thing I could think of, which was grabbing for straws really, was if this is so well signposted that the interest rates are going up, then you may have people who are thinking of buying a house rushing to try and buy a house before the interest rates go up and fix a rate or something, you know? And I thought, that's the only thing that's going to... But that's really not a mass movement of people, you know? It's a small amount of people that'll account for. So at the moment, you're right, I can't see anything really, you know, stimulating the housing market, can you, for the next couple of years at least?
No, I quite concur. Look, the property is expensive, whether you're, if you're renting, you know it. And it's kind of interesting, actually, rents for the first time, I read a report earlier today, I think it was in London, you know, the area of complete madness in terms of property. But rents have edged down for the first time in a number of years, which to me makes perfect sense. It's just people are priced out. It's bonkers. And obviously things like earnings, wages aren't going up rampantly. A property is expensive. You know, it's stretched multiples against incomes and people's earning capability. And even though we've got a bit of a shortage in this country in terms of new builds, etc., I can't see it running away. I just don't think it makes much sense. So for me, you've got to be a little bit cautious of property related stuff as a consequence. So yeah, I'm not surprised Taylor Wimpey shares are rolling over a bit. They're probably not going to crash unless there's a horrible, absolutely terrible property market. But it's just maybe not as interesting as people think. And if you're looking for dividend income and a bit of capital growth, maybe there's just better things out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff, Chris. Thanks for that. And we'll chat next week, fella.
Sounds a good one.
OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are as follows. At five... Boo is ticker there. It's boohoo.com, by the way. At four, Flow Group, ticker Flow. At three, MySquare Limited, MYSQ. At two, Valix, VAL. I do hold that. At one, Feedback, FDBK. It's good to see those two companies there. I had cracking news out yesterday, and people are following those, doing further research. Well done, you, if that's you following. And you. Oh, yeah. And... No, not you, actually. No. All right. Here's the top five most popular RNSs for the last 24 hours. They are as follows. At five, Seeing Machines. Ticker there is C. Only two E's, one S. Automotive Design Award with Premium German OEM. Okay. At four, it's Main Energy. That's update on heavy oil sands project, Utah Saints. MYN ticker there, of course. At 3, strategic minerals, Lee Creek Copper Project work program set. At 2, sound energy, preliminary competent persons report, A1 prospect. Very odd that I couldn't say competent. I think that's quite telling there. I have a problem with the word competent. Oh, the irony, eh? And at 1, it's Mayen Energy, MYN, notice of gas discovery at Stockdale Field. That's it for the podcast. Two from Min in there, two from Mayen. It's quite good. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz, discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.